All right, good afternoon. It is Thursday, no, Tuesday, Tuesday afternoon. I wish it was Thursday. Tuesday afternoon, February 23rd, and we're doing the afternoon Chem 12B lab. And what I want to talk about is the multi-step reaction. Oh, and I need to screen share. You can't see a single thing that I'm doing. That is not helpful in any way. Much better. Okay, so multi-step third reaction. So what we did, just sort of to recap where we're sitting at, we took benzaldehyde. We reacted that with thiamine hydrochloride. That reaction condensed the benzaldehyde into benzoin. And then benzoin was further reacted in an oxidation with nitric acid into benzyl. Benzyl was then or will be reacted with potassium hydroxide in a base catalyzed isomerization reaction called a pentacol-pentacolone rearrangement. And this makes benzylic acid. So it is an oxidation, but also a rearrangement. And this is the reaction that I want to talk about today, is this third step. And how that goes together. Each step of this reaction, we have decreased in the amount of material that we have available to do the reaction. This first one, we used 1 gram of material. In the second one, we used 0.3 gram. And in this last one, we're just gonna use 0.1 gram. And that happens because each step along the way, we lose material and we have less and less to work with. And so these reactions are being scaled down each step. We're also scaling down in the size of the glassware that we're using. We used a 25 mil round bottom flask for the first reaction. We used a 5 mil conical vial for the second. And for the third, we're going to use a 3 mil. And all the glassware that we're going to use for this last reaction is going to be pretty small. Everything that we're going to use is going to be like around 10 milliliters in volume for all the glassware that we're going to do.
So this scaling down is an estimate, but we would actually use all of whatever our product is.
No, we actually would scale it down. We actually would scale the reaction down to this level. In some cases, what I allow students to do is to scale the reaction up a little bit if they have more material and allow them to use a little bit more. But in general, it's not, I haven't taught you how to scale reactions yet. And in general, it's not a good idea to just double the size of a reaction. When you double the size of a reaction, there's a lot of things that happen heat-wise and solubility-wise that need to be considered in terms of changing the reaction. And it's easier to downscale a reaction than it is to scale a reaction up. It's a lot easier to take something and cut it in half and to control the heat and the addition and the solubility than it is to scale something up and understand what happens with the heat, the reaction time, and the solubility, and all of that. It becomes much more difficult to scale something up. So in general, even if, let's say that we took this 1 gram, and let's say that we've got 0.8 grams over here, to scale this up to 0.8 grams would take more than a 5 mL conical vial. We'd have to do it in a 25 mil round bottom, and we'd have to change the solvents and maybe even the reaction time a little bit and control the temperature in a different way. And because of all of those changes, it's easier just to follow the setup that's in the book and to go through and to take and start with 0.3 grams or maybe even 0.4 grams at most and follow it through with that. Your reaction yield doesn't change, because your overall yield is the percent yield from the first times the second times the third. And so the yield that we would get at the end would be unchanged regardless of how much we start with. The amount that you're holding in your hand would be different, but your percent yield overall would not change as long as you were competent with all the steps and got equivalent sort of yields on all the steps. So that's the way that we go through and do that. Okay, let's take a look at the mechanism of this step. It's a base cast catalyzed oxidation and isomerization. We use a strong potassium hydroxide solution. And the hydroxide then is the nucleophile. The benzyl acts as the electrophile. And what we have is we have a partial positive and a partial minus on the carbonyl, which constitutes the polarity of that carbonyl bond. That makes the carbon an electrophile. And we're reacting this with hydroxide as our nucleophile. So the reaction is that that hydroxide attacks the carbonyl base. And yeah, I'll just leave it this way. I was going to change it for the other carbonyl. The bond then breaks, the carbonyl bond breaks, and the molecule opens up into a tetrahedral intermediate. These tetrahedral intermediates typically react to close back up, to regenerate the carbonyl, and to kick out a leaving group, if there is a leaving group to kick out. And if not, if there's no leaving group to kick out, then sometimes that's the dead end product. However, in this one, it does attempt to reform and it does eject a leaving group, but the leaving group that it ejects is a little bit odd. It is the phenyl ring, the six member ring system that gets kicked out, and it migrates in like a 1-2 alkyl shift. And so this is the isomerization part. Where it goes through the rearrangement. And so the carbon structure changes on us. We get the two benzene rings on the same carbon, and I'm going to put this oxygen up top. It's a little bit different than I did earlier this morning, but this works out okay. This piece here now is, this is an alkoxide ion, and we have a carboxylic acid. These two functional groups are not compatible. And what winds up happening is there's a base or a solvent assisted shuttling of the proton, deprotonation and then reprotonation. We could draw it all as one step, but I oftentimes prefer to draw it as solvent assisted. So the solvent takes the proton, giving me the carboxylate. I take that back. I want to do one other thing before I do that. Scratch that. I don't want two negative charges at the same time. I'm going to protonate this first. So we'll protonate that alkoxide, grabbing a proton somewhere from the solvent. After we grab that proton, the base then pulls the proton off the carboxylate. And we end up with a carboxylate anion. This then is our initial product, where the potassium is the counter ion. And this we call potassium benzylate. That then we acidify in another step. And we add acid to it, and then we get the benzylic acid. And so we have this intermediate that we isolate. Which is the potassium benzyl. And then we get the benzoic acid after protonation. So why do we do that? I went into a fairly lengthy explanation this morning, which I think I ought to talk about and duplicate. Alcohols and carboxylic acids have different acidities. We understand this. We've did this in lecture. You would have done this in lecture with Zaruba first semester. If we look at an alcohol, the pKa on an alcohol is about 15.7, very similar to water. The pKa on a carboxylic acid is 4.5. Orders of magnitude, remember that the scale, the pKa scale, is a logarithmic scale. And so every unit on the pKa is a power of 10. And so this is orders of magnitude more acidic for the carboxylic acid than it is for the alcohol. And if we think about those functional groups and we think about the carboxylic acid and its conjugate, which is the carboxylate, and we think about the alcohol and its conjugate, which is the alkoxide, then what we have is we have the strong acid and for the alkoxide we have strong base because they run opposite to each other. We have the most acidic is going to have the least basic conjugate and the most basic will have the least acidic. And so what we have is we have here a weak base and a strong base and a weak acid and a strong acid. So in a competition, when these two are competing within the same molecule, it's unique in that we look at the carboxylic acid and the alkoxide and an equilibrium with the carboxylate and the alcohol. And we can think about this as the strong acid and the strong base. The weak base and the weak acid. And that the weak side is always favored. So in an equilibrium sense, this side, the weak side, is always favored. And so equilibrium-wise, we just have a little arrow to the left and a large arrow to the right. And this is happening within the same molecule. So the two R groups are linked together. So it happens all within one molecule. And yet we can draw it as the proton being taken in one step. I could just take this negative charge, pull the proton, kick the electrons back to the oxygen, and people do draw that all the time. But in reality, these things are almost always solvent assisted in the way that they move, and it's not oftentimes that it happens intermolecularly, or it happens both. And so because it happens both ways, it's good just to show it's solvent assisted as being one of the main options for that proton to shuttle back and forth. So that's that piece. Then we get into how the reaction is actually run. So apparatus-wise, what we're going to do is we're going to take and set up a jack stand. And on that jack stand, we'll set up a hot plate. And then on that hot plate, we're going to put a 5 mL conical vial or 3 mL conical vial, and we're going to set it inside a sand bath. And we're going to attach to it the air condenser. This is not actually going the way that I wanted to do. I'm going to draw the same thing, but I'm going to start my drawing bigger so that you can actually see kind of the setup. We throw in the triangular spin vane. We attach the cap with the air condenser. To this guy, we also take in and throw in a thermometer next to it. This guy all goes inside a sand bath, and we pile sand up along the edges so that the sand fills up the bath a little bit. And we use that as a heating method. all of this sits on top of the hot plate with a ring stand behind it. And then that guy all sits on top of the jack stand. All right, that's a little better. And then back here, we clamp that thermometer in place and we clamp it on the air condenser. So all of that gets set up. And then we start adding in the reagents and the components that we're going to put to this. So here are the reaction instructions. We add 0.10 grams approximately of the benzyl into a 3 mL conical vial. Add spin vane and condenser. Then what we do is add 0.3 mL of 95% ethanol and heat approximately 100 degrees C until dissolved. Then what we're going to do is we're going to add 0.25 mL of 8 molar KOH.
Could you go back up to the first step for just a second?
Yeah. I can leave that there while I'm writing. Whoa, sorry. Zoom dummy. We add 0.25 mL of 8 molar KOH dropwise through the condenser. And then we boil this with stirring for about 15 minutes. And so to hit that boiling point, we're trying to see it start to boil and reflux a little bit. That means that we're shooting for about 115 degrees Celsius. So we might need to heat this up just a little bit more as we do that. And while this reaction is proceeding, it turns this deep, deep blue, black color. As the reaction proceeds. And after the 15 minutes, then we just cool it down to room temperature. Let's just say stop and cool to room temp. And then we start the workup procedure. So the reaction really doesn't take very long at all. It's only 15 minutes with the reaction time. But setup wise, it takes a good sort of like 45 minutes to set this up, to run this, and then to cool it down, and then to start the workup procedure. And the workup procedure is more involved than the other two. It takes quite a bit more work to actually go through and do this workup. So the workup procedure involves isolating the intermediate, and that's the potassium benzylate. So what we do is we transfer the contents to a 10 milliliter beaker. We ice bath it for about 15 minutes. It may require some scratching at this point in order to induce crystallization. You could also do this with a seed crystal. If you had a partner or a friend on the lab bench who theirs crystallized pretty readily and you wanted to just steal a seed crystal, you can sometimes get that to work too, one way or the other. Then what we do is we filter on Hirsch funnel. And we rinse, and this is critical, with 3 times 1 milliliter of 95% ETOH ethanol. What's critical is not water. That what you're isolating here when you do this is you're isolating the potassium benzoate salt. It is a material that is ionic in nature. And with this carboxylate makes it highly, highly water soluble. If you rinse the filter with water, your material dissolves immediately and proceeds on through the funnel into the sidearm flask. And so what you're doing here is you've got the funnel, which is set up and sitting inside the sidearm flask. This guy is all set to give you your solid on the filter paper. And so in here, we're expecting the solid to be captured, and that's our intermediate. And what's down in here is the 95% ETOH and the potassium hydroxide that's remaining. If you add water to it, then what happens is, and this is the solid that we're making, if you add water to it, the water will carry your solid down into the 95% ethanol, and it will make a water 95% ethanol KOH and your product solution, and you will never recover it. It becomes darn near impossible to recover it out of this water mixture once you do that. And so it's really critical that what we do is we rinse it with 95% ethanol, because being ionic, this isn't soluble in methanol. It's water soluble. And so we're rinsing it with the 95% ethanol, trying to rinse the KOH off of it without dissolving it or losing our product. That's what we're trying to do. And it's important that anytime we use these rinses, that we're cooling those rinses down to 0°C, that we ice those rinses and we get those rinses super cold before we go through and actually rinse anything. That also helps so that we don't dissolve our solid. We're trying to maintain that solid as much as we can. Okay, once we get the solid, then what we do is we transfer the solid to a small 10 mil Erlenmeyer flask. we're getting ready to protonate it. And we're going to do that protonation in a small flask. So we use a little tiny baby 10 milliliter Erlenmeyer flask. And we add to it with 3 milliliters of hot DI water. We attempt to stir to dissolve the solid. Okay, everything should dissolve because now we're taking and we're dissolving that into water. So we're taking a little tiny baby Erlenmeyer flask with 3 mils of water. And we're putting that ionic material into it. Anything that doesn't dissolve is not ionic. If it's ionic, it would dissolve. But anything that's a solid that doesn't want to dissolve, these things, solids are impurities. So if you get solids, if you have things that don't want to dissolve, then we have to remove those solids because those solids would be captured in our next step. And this is our chance to remove them if there happens to be any solids. The problem is that if there are any solids, they're hard to remove because they're tiny. So the way that we do that is that we filter them. We set up another Hirsch funnel and we filter them on Hirsch, but paper is not sufficient to dissolve them in a Hirsch funnel. We need to use what's called a C-Lite filter. So this is an if step. Check to see if there are solids. If there are solids, filter out on Hirsch funnel with C-Lite. Okay, C-Lite is a material that is diatomaceous earth. It's an inert material that is extremely fine like talc, and it is used for a number of different processes within chemistry. Usually we use it as a filter medium because it can be dissolved in water and then it can be laid down in an even homogeneous layer that other liquids can pass through, and yet it will retain solids. And so we make this filter by simply taking a beaker, 0.5 gram of C-Lite, and we put in 0.5 grams C-Lite and like 3 milliliters of water. You make a slurry out of it. And at the same time, you set up the Hirsch funnel and you add the paper into the Hirsch funnel. So you have the disc here and then there's a piece of paper that sits on that, that covers the disc. This all goes on a clean sidearm flask. And the sidearm flask has to be cleaned. You can't use a dirty one. Sometimes students get lazy and they just throw an old dirty one on there. Because what they assume is that the material that goes through the funnel is waste. And then if it goes into a dirty funnel, waste into a dirty funnel is waste anyway. So what does it matter? However, this is the reverse. Any solids that get captured are the waste. The liquid that goes through contains your material. And so we need the sidearm flask to be really clean because your material is going to get trapped in it. We pour, number one, the C-Lite into the funnel. The C-Lite then fills this up and makes a C-Lite filter. And then you flow your material through and you pass your solution through that. So this is number one, paper, number two, sea light, number three, solution with solids that we're trying to get out. The solution comes down here, and this is now our water and product that have now flown into the sidearm. So your product ends up in the bottom of that. We then take that, and that's what we then acidify. So now moving forward, we acidify solution with half a milliliter of one molar HCl. And we take this down to a pH of approximately 2. What you want to do is you're isolating a carboxylic acid. The carboxylic acid has a pKa of 4.5. So by taking the pH down to 2, what we're doing is we're going 2 units below the pKa. That ensures that everything gets protonated and that in the equilibrium between the carboxylate and the carboxylic acid, that everything is going to be in the carboxylic acid form, the molecular form, and should precipitate from solution. So that's our general idea here, is that anytime we're trying to precipitate something, take a look at what pKa that thing is that we're protonating and drop the pH down 2 units below its pKa. That's the general procedure with those. The benzylic acid should precipitate out. When it precipitates out, then we're going to ice it down. So we ice for 5 to 10 minutes. And then we filter on Hirsch again. This time, keeping the solid. And then we're at the end mass, melting point. And IR for that last material. So going through all of that and looking at how all of that works with the separation scheme, remember that separation schemes, when we draw out a separation scheme, they start at the first point where we separate things out, and we draw all of the reactants and products that went into it. So we started with benzyl. We added KOH, a little bit of water. We added ethanol. And we made potassium benzylate. So those are all the things that we've got there. From there, what we did is the potassium benzylate precipitated out and we filtered it. We got a solid. and we got a liquid. In the solid was the potassium benzoate. And there may be some solid impurities that follow with this. So we'll say that there may be impurities that are there. On the other side, we had the benzyl, the KOH, the water, and the ethanol. To this guy, we dissolve it in water. After dissolving it in water, there may be solid. Not everybody gets solid. If those solids are there, these are the impurities. Sometimes we don't get that. Sometimes we just get we get that all of the material is soluble. So some people get to skip that C-late step. I would say usually only one or two people in the class out of 20 people need to do that step. From there, what we do is we take and we acidify this. Oh, there's water in here too. Then we acidify this and we add 1 molar HCl. Again, we get a solid and a liquid. So this represents a filtration again. Your liquid is going to be water and potassium chloride for the most part. You'll also have some HCl because you'll use an excess of that. The solid should be our product. And this time, because of the way this is isolated and using the acid-base properties, this time it really doesn't need to be recrystallized. There's not a whole lot of byproducts that follow it through. And so we typically don't recrystallize at this point. Also, you've got just a tiny bit. And so recrystallizing a tiny bit is really hard. So there's our benzoic acid. And analysis-wise, so that's the whole separation scheme. It's not very long. Although with those filtrations, because you got to do the sheer number of filtrations that you need to do, it takes a lot of steps to clean up the glassware that you're using and to reset it each time. Although we tend to leave the Hirsch funnel apparatuses up. We just take our Hirsch funnel off. We take our sidearm flask. Somebody else comes in, puts their sidearm flask in there, funnel on top of it, and then they just do the filtration too. So we don't break down the entire apparatus every time. And so it's a little bit of sharing that helps to make it all go a little bit faster. All right, analysis wise, we're looking at our starting material, the benzyl, and looking at the structural differences and what we expect from these materials in both their melting points and their IRs. So there's one. And it's always good to sort of think about what it is you expect to see. What do I expect the melting point to be? Do I expect the melting point to be bigger, higher, or lower? Do I expect the IR to change what do I expect those changes to look like? All right, so melting point wise, which one of these is going to have the higher melting point?
Benzoic acid.
Yeah, because of the carboxylic acid. So carboxylic acids usually have higher melting points. They have H bonding versus dipole-dipole. So the higher force, this is going to have about 150 degrees C melting point. The other one is expected to have a 95 degrees C melting point because it only has dipole-dipole forces. So that's one thing in terms of the melting point and what we expect with these. Also, carboxylic acids tend to do what's called dimerize, which means that they act like a more massive molecule. They do hydrogen bonding between the two, and they kind of link up in a dimer, which makes that dimer act as if it has a much higher mass and therefore a much higher melting point. And then IR-wise, if we look at these in terms of IR, the first molecule has no hydroxyl groups. And so we see some carbon hydrogen stretches, and then there's nothing. And then we go in, down into the carbonyls, or the carbonyl, and it has two peaks that are fairly intense right next to each other before it goes into the fingerprint region. And I probably did that way too big. Let's scoot it over. So the carbonyl peak that is here is this guy. And this runs somewhere around 1700 reciprocal centimeters as the carbonyl. In the other one, you have a carboxylic acid and an alcohol. And it is a little different than what we might expect. Okay, so with this one, what happens is the hydroxyl group is fairly sterically protected. So that alcohol doesn't have all the hydrogen bonding that we oftentimes associate with alcohols. And it winds up having a sharp peak to it. And it does this when it is non-H bonding. That's oftentimes what we see when we get a hydroxyl group which doesn't hydrogen bond. And so that's what's happening there. The carboxylic acid portion, the OH bond that is there, is giving rise to this group. So there's your carboxylic acid, which is the jagged sort of expectation that we see there. The carbon hydrogen stretches are this last little piece that are right here that we always expect. We saw those here too. All molecules have that CH stretch. And then there's also the carbonyl portion of the carboxylic acid. And that shows up here around our 1700 number. Now these are going to be, I don't know what the actual numbers are. I need to look them up. But they're not going to be the same. They're going to be moved off from each other. And I anticipate that the carboxylic acid is upfield. I think this is going to be up, and I think this guy is going to be down. But I don't have good numbers to give you. But that's the expectation, is we expect to see a shift from the nature of the carbonyl and the new addition of both the non-hydrogen bonding hydroxyl peak and the carboxylic acid peak. And so those are the things that we're looking for to verify that we've had the transformation. Okay. I think that's about it. that's everything that I wanted to go through in this. What some of the questions that I had this morning that I can kind of hit as well was that people wanted to know how to manage the laboratory notebook with an experiment like this, where we have three different steps. And my advice is to treat them as three different reactions. And so just treat them as three independent individual reactions. However, with their own titles, their own purpose, their own procedure. However, the purpose of all three may be the same. For instance, in my notebook, I said the purpose of this experiment was to do a larger synthesis project that included multiple steps and multiple types of reactions. And that can be true, the same purpose for all three. Your procedure is different for each one, and then you have your data for each one, and you'll be watching them sequentially through the videos and just taking your data sequentially through the videos. What else did I have this morning? I don't know. What questions do you guys have?
I think I still don't fully understand the mechanism and why we deprotonate it and reprotonate it. I got a little lost.
Okay. Let's say this. Let me ask this first. Do you understand the acid-base nature and that carboxylic acids are strong acids and that alkoxides are strong bases? And so this is going to favor the side of the weak base and the weak acid in terms of that. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay. So what's happening in one sense, we could say that this alkoxide is taking the proton from the carboxylic acid. And where I use BH, you can consider BH to be another molecule with the carboxylic acid in it. And where I use B minus, you can consider B minus to be another molecule that has the O minus in it. And so these molecules are all in solution and they're bumping into each other. And one is acting as an acid and another is acting as a base, and they are exchanging the proton in that way. Does that satisfy it?
Yeah, so we're not actually doing anything to it. It's just doing it to itself.
Exactly. And there's no way to prevent it. It's the nature of those functional groups and it's seeking its equilibrium point. And there's no way to prevent it. You couldn't stop it if you tried. All right, anything else come up?
Yeah. After we do the Hirsch funnel the first time, are we gonna get a mass then too?
Every time you isolate a solid, I like to grab a mass just to know where things are at. When you grab the mass, you're gonna be getting the mass of potassium benzylate. The mass of potassium benzylate, potassium is heavy, a lot heavier than a proton. So it's gonna make it look like you have a lot of material. And then you go to acidify it and you lose everything. You go, where'd all my material go? But if you look at it on a mole to mole basis, it should work out okay. You just have to realize that, yes, you're going to have potassium in that mass. And so that's going to up your mass by what, 40 grams per mole. It ups it a lot. Okay. And timing wise, so where I'm at in the videos, I had the first video of the benzoin synthesis up. I now have taken all of the video up to the point where I need to do the melting point and the IR on that. And so I have the isolation, all the video of the isolation taken. And I've already started the second reaction. So I have video of the second reaction. And I'm at the point of the recrystallization of the second reaction in terms of work that I've done. I'll go in and take the melting point in the IR on that first material. I just assumed it was good and move forward with it without taking the melting point in the IR, which was not, you can't tell with movie magic. So it should work out okay, because I'll put it together all sequentially. But I was trying to optimize my work time in the lab and my filming time. And so I was going to gang all of my spectroscopy and melting points together. So hopefully I'll go in Wednesday and get the last little bit of video that I need and then get those videos up for this weekend. And I should have the first two reactions up entirely for this weekend. And then we'll look at getting the third reaction up next week. So that's kind of like timing wise where I'm looking at.
By the way, I really appreciate how you do them.
Thank you.
Like the lab videos. I know it takes a long time for you to like edit and stuff, but they're really good for like learning how what you would actually do. So
thank you. Well, and that last one I kind of had fun with because I tried to do a little doodle video explaining what I was doing. I don't know if you guys watched that first one yet for the benzoin synthesis, but I did some new things in that one that I'm trying out to see how it works. So I won't torture you with it here. I'll let you go watch it on your own. You can see the doodle video that I'm trying to do and see how it works. Let me know if that's helpful or not as we try to improve these things. Okay. That's it. That's all I got for you today. That was my hour. And so if you want to hang out and do any sort of office hours or ask me any other questions, I'm perfectly willing to hang out and answer some questions. But I think that's all the information I need to get to you guys today. And then it's just me trying to get those videos up and rolling. Okay.
Thank you.
All right. So I'm going to end the recording. I'll let you guys go. And anybody's welcome to stay on the line and hang out and pepper me with questions if they like. Oh, and I didn't have the chat up. Thank you. All right. Awesome. Thanks, guys.